Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. From bodybuilding to weight loss, protein is revered in the dietary world. It's found virtually everywhere in the body, muscle, bone, skin, hair, and in nearly every aisle of the grocery store, with products ranging from protein-enriched potato chips to protein-enriched Cheerios. But can you get too much of a good thing? We're talking about the role of protein in our diets. Monica Reinagle is a nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. She recently wrote about protein on her website, nutritionovereasy.com. Check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Monica Reinagle joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Monica.
Good morning, Ann. Great to be here.
What is protein? What function? It's a building block, right, for the human body, but what is it?
Exactly. So we use protein to build all of our different structures and cells, but it's also one of the three major what we call macronutrients in food, and the other two are carbohydrates and fats. So those are the sort of trinity that food is made up of, and for a long time, didn't it seem like all we were talking about was fats and carbohydrates, for better or for worse? But now protein is having its moment. I think it was long overlooked as just sort of a necessary but uninteresting part of the diet. And now it's really front and center of nutrition research as maybe an overlooked tool in our attempts to maintain healthy weights and even more importantly, in our attempts to age more successfully.
What function does it play in the body when you talk about in terms of age, for instance?
Okay, that would take us the rest of week to go through. There's very few functions that protein isn't involved with. But in regard to healthy aging, one of the things that really characterizes the aging body, and by that I mean anybody really over 50 is kind of on that path, and one of the things that we notice that's most dramatic is a gradual loss of muscle tissue. And that not only means that, okay, so we're not benchmarking or bench pressing our weight anymore, but it leads to all kinds of other things. We're not as energetic as we used to be. Our bones begin to thin. Our immune system starts to flag. We're losing muscle tissue, and that all adds up to what we have come to think of as a very typical aging process. And by making sure that we're getting more protein as we get older, a lot of that can be slowed or halted. If we can keep our bodies from losing lean muscle tissue as we age, a lot of those other complications can also be slowed. So this is very exciting.
I'm asking for a friend right now. Does the type of protein you eat matter?
Sure. The protein really does differ in its biological quality, depending on what the source is. And the primary choice you have is whether you're going to get your protein from animal sources or plant sources. And there are a lot of arguments to be made for both sides. Plant sources are less expensive, they are easier on the environment, they don't involve the exploitation of animals, all those kinds of things. However, there are some things that we can get from animal protein that it's much harder to get from vegetable protein. So if your belief system and everything else allow for it, I think having at least a little bit of animal protein in the diet is probably best for our bodies.
What do you get from animal protein that you can't get from a handful of almonds?
Well, what you get is a much potent mix of amino acids, of essential amino acids. You could get the same amount of amino acids from almonds, but you'd have to eat a couple of pounds worth to get the same quality, the same amount of those essential amino acids as you would get in just a small serving of beef or chicken or even Greek yogurt. So then it becomes a little bit of a calorie issue. It can take anywhere from 10 to 20 times as many calories to get the same amount of protein from a plant-based source as it does to get it from an animal-based source. So there's a lot of different things that come into play.
Yeah, a friend of mine who is pretty much a vegetarian said that she was recommended to start eating a little bit of meat protein because of the muscle tissue issue.
It really is superior in terms of preserving muscle mass as we get older. But I want to just say, you know, that's not an option for everyone
right.
for all kinds of reasons. And there are certainly ways to build a healthy diet, to age successfully as, let's say, a vegan. But vegans will have to work a little bit harder to get the same amount or anywhere near the same amount and the same quality of protein as omnivores will. So that's just something that you need to take into consideration if that's your lifestyle choice.
Are some high protein foods better for you than others? I mean, we're seeing protein enriched foods all over the place now.
Yeah.
Does it matter, you know, what vessel that involves?
Yeah, I think that is a little bit of, you know, marketing run wild, especially when I see things like protein-enhanced Cheerios. That was
yeah.
actually, it was interesting that you picked that one out in your introduction, because that was a little bit of a scandal.
Oh,
when,
okay.
When GE brought out the protein-enhanced Cheerios, this was totally in response to the general public interest in getting more protein. You know, they realized, oh, consumers are turned on by protein. Let's give them something. The protein-enhanced Cheerios were only fractionally higher in protein than the regular old Cheerios,
uh-huh.
but about four times as high in sugar as the regular Cheerios. So it was totally a step in the wrong direction. And, you know, an example of how, you know, an attempt to capitalize on a marketing claim really led the manufacturer astray and ended up leading consumers kind of down the garden path as well. So, you know, every time we talk about any nutritional element, we're always better off when we're getting it from whole foods or minimally processed foods than we are from highly processed manufactured versions. So much gets lost in processing, and a lot of stuff that we don't want gets added to the mix.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the role of protein in the human diet. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Monica Reinagle, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Monica Reinagle is a nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website as well. Some of the popular diets of the last decade, like paleo and Atkins, encourage tons of protein, lots of eggs and bacon, and cutting back or zero to little carbs. Is it always an either or, Monica?
No, of course it doesn't need to be an either or. And I do personally prefer a dietary prescription that doesn't go to extremes, either high or low on any nutrient, but eats all of the nutrients, the protein, the carbs, and the fats in a balance, and then to focus on the quality of the sources. You know, where are you getting your protein? Where are you getting your fat? I just think that offers a better chance for well-rounded nutrition and avoids the risks of really overdoing it with any one nutrient. So that's my personal preference. Now, I don't think that we necessarily need to be eating tons of carbohydrates,
mm-hmm.
But I don't think that we need to be completely eliminating them in order to eat healthy.
What about protein powders? I do smoothies a lot. I use a protein powder, but I'm never sure if that's just another scam or not.
Well, I use a protein powder, too.
Okay.
It kind of depends on what's in it. You know, there are ones that are all tricked out with all kinds of flavors and bells and whistles and herbs and added nutrients. I steer clear of those,
mm-hmm.
and I look for a plain, unsweetened, unflavored protein powder. I tend to go with whey protein powder just
right.
because it's relatively inexpensive. It's very easy to digest. It's a really high-quality protein. It's easy to find. The role of protein powder, now that is obviously a somewhat processed food, right? That's not a whole food.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I make room for that in my diet is that another thing that we can do to get more benefit from the protein that we eat, without even necessarily eating more of it, is to spread it out more evenly over the day so that we're getting the maximum sort of muscle-building benefit from that protein. What happens in the States, I don't know if this is true for you, Anne, is that we tend to eat 60 or 65% of our protein for dinner. And then breakfast and lunch are relatively light on protein.
Hmm.
So over the course of the entire day, it adds up to a completely sufficient amount. but we're only getting that big chunk of protein at the end of the day, and we're missing out on the benefits earlier in the day. So for most people, the biggest thing that they can do to improve the benefit that they're getting from protein is to move some of that protein into to increase the protein in breakfast and at lunch. And protein powder is just such an easy way to do that because, as you said, you can throw a scoop of protein powder with some yogurt and some fruit in a smoothie and double the amount of protein in your breakfast in a single scoop, you know, and that's just very convenient and helps to spread that protein a little bit more evenly throughout the day. And then, of course, the other end of that is then we don't need to be eating as much protein as we're eating at dinner. Those protein portions, that 12-ounce sirloin or whatever it is, could be trimmed, could really be cut in half and instead, you know, sort of transposed earlier in the day.
So when we talk about protein in our diet, it matters as much how you meet that out as it does what you're eating.
Yes, the spacing of the protein. This is something that is a relatively new insight. You know, when we make our protein recommendations for how much you should be getting, we're used to making those on a per-day basis. We tell you, you know, make sure you're getting at least 50 grams of protein a day. And now we're starting to talk more in terms of per meal. Try to be getting at least 20 grams of protein per meal because, you know, it adds up to almost the same amount of protein, but your body gets way more benefit from it. So that is one way that we're kind of refining our protein recommendations and that we as consumers can do better is to think more in terms of meal and not just over the course of the entire day.
Monica, I have a question about protein and fasting and exercise. Can you address that?
I don't know. Let me.
All right. I'm going to give you a shot at it. I don't know if whether it's from Justin who writes, I read all sorts of conflicting information regarding fasting before exercising. The typical argument against fasting before exercising is that while you exercise, your body will cannibalize your own protein during the workout. And they're asking if that's true, and they ask if it's better to fast before a workout and force your body to utilize its own fat reserves or whether that will cause protein and muscle loss.
Yeah, there's a lot of research on this. And although there are some differences in how the body taps into its various energy sources, it doesn't look like over the long run it really makes a big difference in terms of your results. You know, whether you're exercising on an empty stomach or you've eaten 2 or 3 hours before. And in terms of, you know, using the body's own protein sources, that's not really the danger. And the best thing you can do to preserve your muscle is to make sure that you're getting some protein after your workout to rebuild the muscles. And that can help preserve muscle and build muscle when you're working out is to make sure that your post-exercise meal has some protein in it and some carbohydrates. So in terms of whether you're better off exercising fasted, and all that really means is you get up in the morning and before you have any breakfast, you do your workout rather than having breakfast and then working out. For me, that comes down to your personal comfort. I actually do that. I exercise before I have breakfast purely for the reason that I feel sick to my stomach if I have food in my stomach when I'm exercising. So for me, it's purely a comfort issue. I have a friend who is the opposite. If she hasn't eaten, she feels sick to her stomach when she's exercising on too empty a stomach. So the best workout is going to be the one that you do. So let's make ourselves comfortable.
An email from David, he asks, does protein help build muscle on its own? And should someone consume more protein if they exercise?
Well, the way that protein helps build muscle is in conjunction with exercise. So you need to kind of have both parts of the equation to build muscle. And what was the second part of the question?
And whether you should consume more protein if you do exercise regularly.
Yeah. Right. When you're exercising, it does increase your protein needs, and so it would be a good idea to increase your protein, depending on how much you're taking in now. I guess if you're already taking insufficient, you might not need to increase it. But as a general rule, it does, especially strength training, weight training, that kind of thing, as opposed to things like running or cycling. But when you're using your muscles to lift weights, then you get especially more benefit from increasing protein.
Now, I mean, all this being said, I mentioned at the outset of the segment that most Americans get way more than enough protein in their diets, that they get twice as much. What's the deal with that, and what are the problems with that?
Right. This is a very common misunderstanding. So when people say that Americans are getting, you know, twice as much protein as they should, what they're talking about is that the minimum recommendation for protein intake is 50 grams per day. And that's the amount that's needed just to keep you out of protein deficiency. So
like
that
rickets or something? Or
well, that right. Well, not rickets, but okay. But a similar sort of situation. That is where your body, as the previous emailer suggested, would start cannibalizing its own protein reserves just in order to fuel itself. So.
Okay.
So that 50 grams of protein is the minimum recommended amount, and that is our recommended daily allowance. And most people do get between 1.5 to 2 times that much, but that is not at all too much. Because that minimum recommendation, there's actually a movement in the scientific circles to raise that to a higher level, to something more like 80 to 100 grams per day, because that reflects not just the amount that's needed to keep you out of overt deficiency,
mm-hmm.
but the amount that's needed to keep your body healthy and well-functioning.
Okay.
So I expect actually in our lifetime to see that that recommended daily amount go up significantly.
So you're not troubled that people are consuming twice the recommended at this point?
Oh, no.
Okay,
you know,
gotcha.
Yeah, there's also a recommended maximum, and no one's anywhere close to it.
What is 50 grams of protein? I mean, what does that even look like? How do you figure that out?
That's about 8 ounces of chicken breast, so 2 servings of chicken breast, or an egg would have, say, 6 grams. I actually have a sort of a protein cheat sheet that lists 25 different common foods, meats and cheeses and vegetarian sources and beans and peanut butter and how much protein. And as soon as we're off the air, Anne, I'm going to send your producer a link to it and you can add that to your show notes.
Okay.
Because people can just quickly get an idea if they're trying to add up to 20 in a meal, 20 grams in a meal or 60 grams over the course of the day, they can just at a glance see what kinds of foods they'd have to put together in order to hit that goal.
Do the protein needs differ between children and adults?
Yeah, mostly because of their size.
Okay.
You know, children are not just tiny adults. You know, there are really important differences. But when we're looking at their protein requirements, it's more or less scaled to their size. And the good news is most children and toddlers are getting, you know, all the protein they need. We're not worried about amping up the protein. And,
okay.
And I also don't think that we need to be going out of our way to give our toddlers more protein. It's probably more important to make sure that we're covering all of those other nutrient needs rather than amplifying the protein any more than it already is.
And then one last question before I let you go. What is the best vegetables for protein?
Oh, vegetables are a terrible source of protein.
I know. So
they're great for everything. So the
okay.
vegetable that sort of wins the protein derby are green peas and lima beans and those kinds of things. Those green vegetables that are almost on the edge between being that and a legume.
Gotcha.
Those are going to be the highest protein vegetables, but that's generally not going to be where we're going to find a lot of our protein.
Okay. Monica Reinagle, thank you so much for your time today. I always appreciate your help.
You're so welcome, Anne. Great to be with you.
Monica Reinagle, nutritionist, chef, and creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. You can check out our, she said, our program notes at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. New research from Germany suggests that heavy drinking is associated with abnormal heart rhythms. The researchers conducted this study at where else? Munich's Oktoberfest, a 16-day Bavarian beer festival held every autumn. We're talking about the connection between drinking and heart health right now. Dr. Gregory Marcus is the director of clinical research for the Division of Cardiology at the University of California, San Francisco. He has conducted similar research in the past, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You weren't part of this German study, but you have studied the correlation before. How did you conduct your study?
So we've done studies in a variety of ways, ranging from individual-level research similar to what they've conducted using sensors, as well as population-based research. I think one of the things that's especially intriguing about this sort of research is that there's evidence that alcohol may be beneficial for certain types of heart disease and is likely harmful for other types. I'm happy to expand on kind of the details of what we've done in the past.
Well, let's take the positive point first. Yeah. What's it good for?
So it's important to emphasize that all of the data in this area is what we call observational. So there are no randomized clinical trials.
Right.
So we have to take everything with a grain of salt and be skeptical of any positive results. The data available thus far does suggest that moderate consumption of alcohol might reduce the risk specifically of myocardial infarction, otherwise known as a heart attack. And just to be clear on our definition here, a heart attack is when there is an abrupt occlusion of blood flow to the heart, usually in one of the coronary arteries. So epidemiologic studies have suggested when they look at people who tend to drink in moderate amounts, such as 1 to 2 drinks per day, and they follow them over a long period of time, it looks like they have a lower risk of a heart attack. Again, it's really important to mention that confounding can play an important role in this sort of data. So a good example is estrogen, where we had the exact same findings, where women who took postmenopausal hormone replacement seem to have a lower risk of heart attack if you follow them over time.
Mm-hmm.
However, when there was a randomized trial done, we found that there was no clear protective effect, and in fact, some had a higher risk of a heart attack when they took estrogen. And in retrospect, it was very likely that it was just that the people who tended to receive estrogen replacement therapy tended to be those that engaged in other healthy activities, such as they went to see their doctor more, they did what their doctor said, they exercised more, they probably were of a higher socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really prove things either way. The data thus far, though, does suggest that there may be a lower risk of heart attack. To try to address this, we conducted a study where we looked at different counties in Texas where in some counties, alcohol sales are prohibited still, and in others, there's no prohibition on alcohol sales. And what we found was that in the counties where alcohol sales were fully allowed, there was a lower risk of heart attack compared to the what we called the dry counties where they didn't allow sales of alcohol. Now, the flip side is that there's also compelling evidence that those who drink more alcohol are at higher risk of a very important heart rhythm disorder called atrial fibrillation. Whereas we've done a very good job in cardiology and in public health in reducing the incidence of heart attacks, it looks like atrial fibrillation, if anything, is becoming more and more common. And this is important because it can reduce the quality of life of patients who have it to a similar extent as those who have had heart attacks. And most importantly, atrial fibrillation carries a very high risk for stroke.
What is atrial fibrillation?
Sure. So I think it's important to first set the stage for the normal electrical activity of the heart.
Okay.
So the heart has four chambers. There are two chambers in the top that are called the atria and two chambers in the bottom called the ventricles. The atria normally are activated by something called the sinus node, which is in the upper part of the right atrium. That is our normal biological pacemaker that fires about 60 to 80 times per minute at rest and will respond to adrenaline and go faster when we are scared or excited, and when we're asleep, it'll go slower. And that electrical impulse is propagated throughout those top two chambers, the atria, in a very organized fashion. The top chambers are not electrically connected directly to the ventricles. They have to go through another structure called the AV node to reach the ventricles. And then as the ventricles are electrically activated, they squeeze, again, in a very coordinated fashion, mm-hmm. to deliver blood to the heart. And that's really what generates the pulse. The atria have a little kick that delivers some blood to the ventricles to help the ventricles to fill, but it's really the ventricles that are delivering the pulse and maintaining our blood pressure. So in atrial fibrillation, what happens is that the atria, rather than having this very coordinated regular activity at a normal rate, quiver in an extremely disorganized, very rapid fashion. So if we put a catheter, for example, which we do in many of our procedures, that can record electrical activity in the atria, you can count a beat every about 400 times per minute, extremely fast and totally chaotic. Fortunately, the AV node, and by the way, that rate is not compatible with life.
Okay.
Fortunately, an important property of that AV node that, again, connects electrically the upper chambers to the bottom chambers can't conduct that fast. So it essentially protects the lower chambers such that the heart rate in atrial fibrillation, it can be quite variable depending on a number of things, but it tends to go too fast, inappropriately fast, usually around 120, 130, 140, and young, healthy people can go much faster. But the pulse becomes, because the ventricles then are being activated at that more rapid rate, irregular and rapid. And then, so that can make people feel fatigued. It can make people feel like their heart is jumping out of their chest. It can make people feel out of breath. Now, that doesn't explain the stroke part. The stroke part is attributed to the fact that the atria, because they are quivering and they're no longer squeezing in a coordinated fashion, that blood flow tends to accumulate or tends to slow down and just kind of sit there.
Hmm.
And we know when there's stasis of blood, that it tends to clot.
Okay.
And so a blood clot can form, and it does seem to tend to form in a particular structure in the left atrium. And if that blood clot breaks off and it goes to the brain, it can cause a stroke. There's now more and more data that probably atrial fibrillation doesn't just increase the risk for stroke, but probably other problems due to blood clots traveling elsewhere. So if a blood clot goes down a coronary artery, it can cause a heart attack. If it goes down to an artery supplying the kidney, it can cause kidney problems. There's data now as well that people with atrial fibrillation may be at risk for dementia long term. Now, the very good news I just want to emphasize before I cause a panic is that there are very effective therapies for this. Specifically, by far, the most important therapy to really reduce death, to reduce stroke, are anticoagulants. And we can get into that because there's a lot of kind of myth out there that I think is probably more...
Are these like blood thinners?
Yes,
okay.
Blood thinners. Exactly.
Now, let's get back to the drinking part of this.
Yeah.
What does drinking have to do with atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating question exactly because we don't understand the fundamental mechanism. So the history of this is that clinicians noticed that that people seem to be coming into the emergency room with a new onset atrial fibrillation in the setting of binge drinking. And this has a name called the holiday heart syndrome. So subsequently, people then looked at these large epidemiologic studies and looked at the people who, when they first enrolled in these big NIH-funded studies, described, okay, yeah, I drink two glasses of wine a day or more. And over time, we've fortunately had decades now where we've been able to follow those people. And it turns out that people who drink more, it's not consistent in every study, but almost all of them, this is the finding, that those who describe more drinking at baseline have a higher risk of atrial fibrillation long term. Now, again, what is the mechanism? So I personally think, and this is speculation based on some evidence, that there are two things going on. That one, alcohol may have a chronic effect that increases the risk of developing atrial fibrillation for the first time. And two, that alcohol might have more of an acute effect where it actually is doing something to the electrical properties of the heart that increases the risk of an episode acutely. So even in someone who has a history of atrial fibrillation, they've already developed the disease, when they drink, in some people, there's some evidence that may trigger the episode. So we did a study going back to the chronic where we looked, used data from the Framingham Heart Study, which is one of these NIH-funded cohorts, where they have not only they took a history regarding alcohol use. They also obtained echocardiograms, which are essentially ultrasounds of the heart, mm-hmm. every few years. And then they also followed people to see if they developed atrial fibrillation. And what we found was that those who drank tended to have, over time, a larger left atrium, which means it's dilating. And we know that a larger left atrium itself is a risk factor for atrial fibrillation.
Is that like an enlarged heart when we hear that reference?
Usually when you hear enlarged heart, people are referring to the lower chamber okay. of the heart. And it's also known, I should mention, that heavy alcohol use can cause an enlarged lower chamber, which made us think about this hypothesis.
There's a certain kind of people, you refer to the holiday heart syndrome, that people who don't think they're heavy drinkers because they only drink heavily occasionally, and they
right.
binge.
Yeah.
That's a certain thing.
Right. So it looks like the current evidence suggests that people who tend to drink more chronically are at higher risk for developing atrial fibrillation, and then that those who drink heavily in the short term may be at risk for a given episode. So we're doing a couple of studies to try to investigate this. So one is we have people who have they already have the diagnosis of atrial fibrillation. We are giving them a wearable patch that can monitor their heart rhythm continuously. We give them a wrist device and an ankle device, both of which can measure alcohol in sweat, essentially, which is a good can reflect blood alcohol concentration. And we're trying to determine if, indeed, does alcohol in the very short term, and even at a lower dose, does that seem to increase the risk for atrial fibrillation? Another study we have is we're taking people undergoing ablation, which is one therapy for atrial fibrillation, where we put catheters in through veins into the heart, and we burn around the pulmonary veins in the left atrium, which seems to work for many patients with atrial fibrillation. We are randomizing them to an intravenous infusion of alcohol versus placebo. We have a special model that was developed at the NIH where we can titrate that by serial breathalyzers to exactly where we want it. So we're getting the alcohol patients to 0.08% alcohol, and we can clamp it there.
The legal limit, yeah.
Right, versus the placebo. And in everyone, we're doing a very comprehensive assessment of the electrical properties of their heart using the catheters that we have in their upper chambers by pacing them and doing various measurements.
What's it like to study people who are at the legal limit for alcohol consumption?
Yeah, well, so this is kind of a special group because they're already sedated. They're actually under general anesthesia, and this is the benefit of having the placebo group. So we can kind of hopefully sort out the effects of general anesthesia versus alcohol. I will say we've been pleasantly surprised that thus far we've infused 58 patients, and none have had any problems. When they wake up, we really can't tell the difference between those who received alcohol versus those that didn't.
Well, how do you know that, you know, a lot of times when people are binge drinking, they're also binge dancing or binge doing something else stupid?
Yeah, no, great question. So there could be some other factor, which is where this randomization comes in, and that's where this controlled experiment should help take care of that, right? We know everything is exactly the same to the best of our ability, with the exception of the fact that half these people in a random order are getting intravenous alcohol and half of them are getting essentially salt water.
Okay. That, this is really interesting. I could ask you a million questions. But how, in the short term, what is your recommendation, Dr. Gregory Marcus, to people who tend to binge drink? They're holiday drinkers. Oh, yay, yeah. It's 4th of July or Memorial Weekend. We're coming into that holiday, holiday segment of our year. What's your recommendation?
Yeah. Well, so let me answer that by also describing another study we recently published, which looks specifically at alcohol abuse, where binge drinking from a medical standpoint would be considered one form of alcohol abuse. There are many different forms of this. So we did a study where we looked at essentially every hospitalization and ER visit in California, in the state of California, over 5 years. So we had 50 million records of healthcare encounters. And we looked at the people who had any diagnosis of alcohol abuse, whether it was binge drinking, whether it was chronic use, and then we followed them over time to see what happened to them. And we found that those people were at higher risk not only of atrial fibrillation, but also of heart failure, which is when the lower chambers fail and you have too much fluid builds up, and very importantly, heart attack. So contrary to what I told you early on, this study we think was important for a few reasons. Number one, the great majority of all the research, I already mentioned it was observational, it also always relies on the individual self-reporting how much alcohol they drink.
Right.
So this research, we didn't need that. We didn't use that at all. This was a medical diagnosis. Someone had a healthcare encounter where a physician felt like, this person is drinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
So that eliminated the self-reporting bias from this. And second, what we learned is that if you drink too much, you're not protecting yourself from heart attack. You're actually putting yourself at higher risk of a heart attack. So there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the relationship between alcohol and heart health. But the one thing I think we can safely say is that excess alcohol is almost certainly not good for you, even if it's once in a while. So I definitely recommend avoiding more than 1 to 2 drinks in one sitting. I generally do not recommend beginning alcohol. For someone who doesn't drink, I would never recommend, oh, yeah, you should start drinking alcohol.
Okay.
The big unknown is, well, for the people who drink once in a while, number one, is that overall good for them or not? I would say we really don't know. I think there's evidence in both directions. And then the second question that often comes up is how much is the right amount? And in general, the American Heart Association, and I would tend to agree with this, recommends about 1 drink per day or not more than 1 drink per day for women and about 2 drinks per day for men.
Dr. Gregory Marcus, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gregory Marcus is Director of Clinical Research for the Division of Cardiology at the University of California, San Francisco. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Every day, 150 workers in the U.S. die from job-related injury or illness. In Ohio, in 2015 alone, more than 200 workers were killed on the job, according to a new report by the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, that is the AFL-CIO. We're talking about the state of safety and health protections for America's workers. Joining us by phone is Senior Safety and Health Specialist at AFL-CIO, Rebecca Reindel. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
First of all, work is where most of us who have a job spend most of their waking hours during a typical work week. So can we distinguish between work-related and just happen to be there more often than not?
That's right. Actually, we can. We have the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which counts every worker fatality in the United States every year. And they have certain criteria, and so they are able to distinguish between a work-related fatality and non-work-related.
And when we talk about work-related, somebody's in a really high-stress job in the advertising industry, you know. Is that what we're talking about or not?
There are a wide variety of work-related deaths
in
the United States. Advertising certainly could be one of them. But more often than not, we do see work-related fatalities very high in other industries. And in 2015, which is the latest data that's out, you certainly see that going on in construction and transportation and agriculture. Those are the most dangerous.
So construction, agriculture, and what?
Transportation.
Transportation. What in transportation?
Right. So it's a little hard to break down sometimes, but we've seen a big increase in truck transportation fatalities that are work-related. In Ohio, certainly, we've seen an increase from 2014 to 2015 in transportation-related deaths as well.
And I was wondering, when it comes to that, when we talk about the 200 workers killed on the job, when it comes to transportation deaths, Ohio is a big pass-through state for trucking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that possibly part of it?
That's part of it. It's not all necessarily happening in long-distance trucking. There are a lot of industries and occupations where transportation happens. Think of construction sites, for instance.
Okay.
You can think of local transportation, so transporting local materials, warehouses where transportation vehicles are used a lot, and then certainly probably some long-distance trucking.
In the report, it said that Latino and immigrant workers continue to be at higher risk than other workers, and I was wondering why that is.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in the latest data that we examined in our report, Latino workers are 18% higher risk on the job of dying on the job than all other workers. And, you know, it's a wide variety of reasons. Certainly, Latino and other immigrant workers have often are working in highly dangerous jobs. And then you have workers who, Latino and immigrant workers who are not always feel that they can speak up on the job. You know, workers in the United States have the right under laws to speak up and report unsafe working conditions, to report injuries and illnesses on the job, and refuse unsafe work. But many workers who feel, you know, marginalized or vulnerable because of their status may not speak up and report those things going on in their workplace, and that leaves them at higher risk. And we certainly do see that in the statistics, where a larger amount of these workers are actually dying on the job.
I know that when I have an injury, they always ask if it's work-related. Do they do the same thing? Is that how the statistics are gathered when it comes to deaths?
No. The Bureau of Labor Statistics uses a census process.
Okay.
It's called, we call it CFOI, the Census of Fatal Occupational Injuries. And they do a census process through all of their states, all of the states in the United States, and their partners. And they collect information from death certificates. They cross-reference them with news clippings and any other information, hospital reports. You know, employers have the responsibility in the United States to report a work-related fatality directly to OSHA when it happens. And they only have a certain window to do that. And if it's, you know, a work-related fatality, if somebody dies on the job, OSHA, and they have the it's in their jurisdiction, they will go out and investigate that. So they're also part of the collection process of this information.
Agriculture obviously is a big deal in Ohio. What do we know about the dangers of that business, of that workplace?
In agriculture, there are a wide variety of dangers. You have a lot of moving and equipment. You have heat stress and illness. And a lot of these workers are also working with pesticides. So it's pretty much across the board in agriculture. It's a very dangerous industry for workers to be in.
When it comes to something like pesticides, a lot of that is something that builds up over time, right? I mean, how do you mm-hmm. trace that back to the workplace?
You know, it's a very good question. It's very difficult. You have this problem for work-related illnesses across the board. It's not only pesticides.
Okay.
We have a lot of workers in this country who are exposed to a lot of toxins in their workplace, such as silica dust, which there was a strong protection standard released last year by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to protect workers against that. And as the case with pesticides, these are illnesses that build up over time, but there are, you know, epidemiological studies that do link exposures to these toxins to certain diseases. In the case of silica, you would have silicosis and lung cancer, and they're able to make that link. But in terms of workers being able to report that and that being counted in the national statistics, it's actually a very weak and limited process right now. There's virtually no national counting of work-related illnesses in the United States, and it's a big problem.
Do employers have any obligation to inform potential employees that there is a danger like pesticides or the silica or whatever it might be?
There are standards, notably the Hazard Communication Standard, which requires employers to notify workers of all the chemicals in their workplace and the hazards that they cause. they are required to provide them protection against those chemical hazards. So they're required to inform the employee about what they can do if, they're exposed, if it's an emergency situation, how to maybe, put out a fire or a burn. But yes, they are required to at least inform employees, given their right to know about any kind of chemical that they are working with in the workplace.
You worked previously for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and what's the role there in protecting American workers?
Right. So OSHA is a small agency with a very limited budget to protect all the workers across the country. And it's an agency, when I was there, I helped work on health standards to try to get some standards out the door that are new safeguards and protections for workers who are, as we already talked about, exposed to chemical hazards on the job. But OSHA has a really big role to play in standard setting, but also in enforcement. OSHA has very limited capacity right now. What we calculated in our latest report is that OSHA's current resources only have the ability to inspect every workplace in the United States. If they were to inspect every workplace once, they would only get there every 159 years. And it comes down to right now about one inspector per 76,000 workers, or a little over $3 per worker in the United States.
So are you mostly driven by complaints then at that point?
OSHA is driven by complaints. It also has programmatic inspections. They do focus and have emphasis programs under for certain high-risk industries. So they will look at statistics, what is going on that year, where the highest injury rates happening, highest fatality rates, and they will definitely place an emphasis on certain industries, but they do have randomized inspections, and so they can still show up to, any workplace really at any time.
The issue of coal miners came up recently in terms of their health coverage at the federal level. They were looking at canceling a program in the Trump budget of health care for coal miners. That was reinstated, I think, or it's going to be. How much is black lung an issue for coal miners, or is there a lot of other issues?
Right. Black lung is a very serious issue that, of course, people have known about for, decades.
Right.
And, I think a lot of people tend to think of black lung as a historic or a disease that used to be a problem. We've actually seen a rise, especially I think there was a study out a few months ago in Kentucky showing the rise of return of black lung, the rates are going back up. And so certainly workers in coal mines are also exposed to silica dust. And so you have OSHA, the agency that passed a standard last year for silica in general industry and construction, but we have a different agency that focuses only on mines, and they focus on coal mines and metal and non-metal mines. And silica dust is also a big problem in the mines, and MSHA has not yet released a safeguard for workers to protect, be protected against silica in the mines.
Rebecca Reindel, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Rebecca Reindel, Senior Safety and Health Specialist at the AFL-CIO. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.